Today we will celebrate books. More appropriately, we will celebrate the reading of books. An infant can sit in front of a TV screen and be happy. So in some cases can a pet dog or cat. We can all marvel at the special effects that Hollywood creates. We love the convenience of needing no effort to passively watch the miraculous things visual media has accomplished. Today, though, we are focused on the printed page. There are no special effects as powerful as our imaginations. There are no pictures as vivid as those our minds create. TV, movies, social media require little effort or concentration. The only thing meant to last seems to be the commercials. Reading needs focus. It relies on the reader to complete it. Quoting famous 20th century philosopher Groucho Marx, television is educational. Whenever someone turns on the TV, I go into another room and read.
So, today is our book communion service. It has always been one of my favorites. Because, like so many of you, I love books. I love to read, the thrill of exploring adventures and characters and dialogue and relationships and happiness, sadness, danger, sorrow, joy, regret, love, hate, success, failure, pain, and healing, with so many interesting characters that emerge from the minds of so many great writers, has been very important to me and has given me uncounted hours of great pleasure. I have loved to read from a very young age. I can hardly remember a time when I could not read. I suppose there must have been at least a short time, like right after I was born. But my parents read to me from the very beginning, which is something we also did with our son, and he also has had a lifelong joy of books and reading. These books and stories helped to make me the person that I am today. They, among other things, inspired my outlook and my principles, and eventually led me to becoming a UU and speaking here at this church. The earliest books that I can remember are, of course, children's books. In elementary school, or what we used to call grammar school, my favorite things in the class were the books, followed closely by the toy train and the make-believe kitchen. My favorites in those days were Dr. Seuss, and he is still popular with our kids today. The way those magical words slid off the page into the mind was amazing. One fish, two fish, red fish, blue fish. Or, through the machines they raced round and about again, changing their stars every minute or two, they kept paying money, they kept running through until neither the plane or the star bellies knew whether this one was that one, or that one was this one, or which one was that one, or what one was who. My earliest readings also came in the form of comic books. People used to put down comics as mindless pulp. But among the adventures of Spider-Man, Daredevil, and the Fantastic Four, there were some pretty darn well-written epics of action, drama, and wonderment. Many of these were written by Stan Lee. My young vocabulary swelled with new words, and I developed a great love of language and the way different authors could manipulate it. My family also loved movies, in particular science fiction, horror, and action movies. So some of the earliest novels that I sought out to read were books that became movies or sometimes books based on movies. One that I read over and over again was Planet of the Apes by Pierre Boulez. Unlike the movie, which as a side note was scripted by Rod Serling, who was a UU, the lead character was a Frenchman called Ulysses Marot. In the year 2500, his ship was on a mission to a solar system orbiting the star Betelgeuse. Eventually, they became involved in the life forms on this planet, the humans, who were dumb brutes, and the simian species, who were intelligent. This led to a wonderful satire on what it means to be human. A description of the ape world's stock exchange was particularly memorable. Apes running back and forth as well as climbing up and down ropes and trapezes, barking while buying and selling stocks. Not too different from our own chaotic systems. I also read Fantastic Voyage by Isaac Asimov, and from this I discovered Asimov's other books, such as the Foundation Trilogy and his iRobot stories. There was also Arthur C. Clarke's 2001 A Space Odyssey, then Clarke's many other works, Childhood's End, Rendezvous with Rama, and so many more. There were a good many fantasy tales being devoured in those days as well. I was particularly fond of Edgar Rice Burroughs. From the jungles of Tarzan to the mysterious cities of Mars and the adventures on Venus and on lost islands of cavemen. Just enough violent sword fights and scantily clad women to set a young man's heart racing. And one had to read J.R.R. Tolkien in high school. The Hobbit and the Lord of the Rings trilogy are milestones in fantasy writing. The Hobbit grabbed me from the very start, as Tolkien described Bilbo's Hobbit hole. The very first paragraph in the book reads, "In a hole in the ground there lived a hobbit, not a nasty, dirty, wet hole filled with the ends of worms and an oozy smell, nor yet a dry, bare, sandy hole with nothing in it to sit down on or eat. It was a hobbit hole, and that means comfort." The Hobbit's adventures with Gandalf the wizard, Aragorn the warrior, and mighty fighting dwarves and elves as they battled armies of orcs to prevent the world from being taken over by evil became the template for many other fantasy epics. They also led to many hours of playing Dungeons and Dragons with my friends. These hours taught me lessons about good and evil, teamwork, bravery, and how to roll dice of many different numbered sides. Reading many horror novels was also a good way of learning how to deal with fear. I have enjoyed the works of Stephen King for many years. The first book of his that I read was Salem's Lot, a very scary story about vampires. I remember laying awake at night after reading it, listening for the evil bloodsuckers who might be just outside my window. But the horror was matched by a cathartic thrill and a wry sense of humor. I find Mr. King's novels to be some of the most entertaining that I have ever read. I devoured many others, such as Cujo, Carrie, Firestarter, The Shining, Misery, The Green Mile, Under the Dome, and my favorite, the story of two generations battling the ultimate evil foe, an other-dimensional clown who called himself Pennywise. The book was called It. I would love to read whole scenes from this book to you, but there isn't time. So many books, so little time. I will mention just a few more. The funniest book that I have ever read was The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy by Douglas Adams. Very few books have been able to make me just laugh out loud while reading. It is the tale of one Arthur Dent, an unassuming Earthman who ends up on an adventure with several alien weirdos after the Earth is destroyed by the Vogons to make way for a new intergalactic freeway bypass. Many lessons are learned along the way, such as don't panic and always remember to bring a towel. I could stand here all day and quote from such wonderful novels as Richard Matheson's The Shrinking Man and I Am Legend, or the Gateway novels by Frederick Pohl, the Amber series by Roger Zelazny, the Game of Thrones novels by George R.R. Martin, the Magic Sword books by Frederick Saberhagen, the Jack Reacher mysteries by Lee Child, the Harry Potter novels by J.K. Rowling, the Dune books from Frank Herbert, the Ender stories by Orson Scott Card, and the Thomas Covenant series by Stephen R. Donaldson. Not to mention the strange and wonderful works of Alice Siebold, Neil Gaiman, Clive Barker, Michael Chabon, and Cormac McCarthy. classics by Shelley, Stoker, Orwell, Salinger, Wells, Lovecraft, and Edgar Allan Poe. But I will close with just one more quote, and then I will turn the pulpit over to a few others who will share some pieces of their most cherished books. It wasn't until college that I gained an appreciation for Shakespeare. I took a class at Chabot where we read and discussed a few plays. Since then, I've watched many interpretations of his works. It is a real joy to read and to speak the language of these plays. A book of his complete works is another of the much-loved volumes on my shelf, and I think it's one that's on the cover of the Order of Service. I love books almost as much as Romeo loved Juliet. One of my favorite quotes comes as Romeo spies Juliet up on her balcony. But soft, what light through yonder window breaks? It is the east, and Juliet is the sun. Arise, fair sun, and kill the envious moon, who is already sick and pale with grief, that thou, her maid, art far more fair than she. The brightness of her cheek would shame the stars as daylight doth a lamp. Her eyes in heaven would through the airy region stream so bright that birds would sing and think it were not night. See how she leans her cheek upon her hand. Oh, that I were the glove upon that hand, that I might touch that cheek. So keep reading. Keep letting the words flow through you. Words have the power to inspire, to illuminate, to educate, to entertain, and to gladden the very heart and soul itself. May it ever be so. Blessed be.
So picture a small room in the library, and there's about 8 or 10 of us gathered. And it comes my turn, and I say, "Hi, I'm Doug. I'm an addict. I'm a book addict." Yes, it's true. I never go anywhere without a book. There might be a minute to read. I love to ride the BART to Berkeley, especially because of the 35-minute trip you can just focus on reading. Yes, I'm hooked, and I blame my mother. She lured me into the habit when I was 7 years old, reading The Wizard of Oz to my sisters and me, all of us sprawled out in their big parental bed. She was a pusher. Yes, I have many wonderful friends and relatives in real life, but the dozens of characters from novels and memoirs are my true virtual friends. Horatio Hornblower, Harriet Vane, Spencer, Pierre Bezenkoff, Jean Cosson, Morris Zapp, Lady Glencora, Laurie Lee, and I often go to sleep reliving Keith Stewart's adventures sailing the Pacific. And oh yes, Leonard Wolfe. Leonard's wife, Virginia Wolfe, was never my fix. But Leonard, oh my, he was just right for me. About 15 years ago, I discovered his 5-volume autobiography and just devoured it. And since then, I've sampled it many, many times with great pleasure. Listen to this. Volume 1, page 1. I very rarely think either of my past or my future, but the moment that one contemplates writing an autobiography, and I'm sitting down with that intention today, one is forced to regard oneself as an entity carried along for a brief period in the stream of time, emerging suddenly at a particular moment from darkness and nothingness, and shortly to disappear at a particular moment into nothingness and darkness. The moment at which officially I emerged from nothingness was the early morning of November 25th, 1880. Though, in fact, I did not personally become aware of my existence until some 2 or 3 years later. In the interval between 1880 and today, as 1964, I have lived my life on the assumption that sooner or later I shall pass by annihilation into the same state of nothingness from which I suddenly emerged that morning that winter morning in West Cromwell Street, Kensington, so many years ago. This passage from non-existence to non-existence seems to me a strange and, on the whole, an enjoyable type experience. Since the age of 16, when, for a short time, like any intelligent adolescent, I took the universe too seriously, I have rarely worried myself about its meaning or its meaninglessness. But I resent the fact that, as it seems to be practically certain, I shall be as non-existent after my death as I was before my birth. Nothing can be done about it, and I cannot truthfully say that my future extinction causes me much fear or pain. But I would like to record my protest against it and against the universe which enacted it. End quote. I'm going back to my seat now, but part of me longs to go off to a cubbyhole somewhere and continue with Leonard.
I see lots of books up here, but I don't see too many self-help books, and they're very important too. In 1995, my brother passed away, so I went through a very bad time in my life, and somebody suggested to me to read a book called The Four Agreements. And this book really helped me out. I went to the Japanese garden every day, and I read this book. So in the spirit of mysticism, I pulled this book out, and I just literally opened it up. And here's what it said to me and to you. Being impeccable with your word is not using the word against yourself. If I see you in the street and I call you stupid, it appears that I am using the word against you. But really, I'm using my word against myself. Because you're going to hate me for this, and your hating me is not good for me. Therefore, if I get angry with my word and send all that emotional poison to you, I am using the word against myself. If I love myself, I will express that love in my interactions with you, and then I am being impeccable with my word, because that action will produce a like reaction. If I love you, then you will love me. If I insult you, you will insult me. If I have gratitude for you, you have gratitude for me. If I'm selfish with you, you will be selfish with me. If I use the word to put a spell on you, you are going to put a spell on me. Being impeccable with your word is the correct use of your energy. It means to use your energy in the direction of truth and love for yourself. If you make an agreement with yourself to be impeccable with your word, just with that intention, the truth will manifest through you and clean all the emotional poisons that exist within you. By making this agreement is difficult because we have learned to do precisely the opposite. We have learned to lie as a habit of our communication with others, and more importantly, with ourselves. We are not impeccable with our words. So I say, be impeccable with your word. Again, this book was written by Don Miguel Ruiz, and it's called The Four Agreements. So, again, there's lots of fiction and fantasy and all those great books out there, but I wanted to add the self-help books to our book communion today. Thank you.
Now, the book that I'm going to talk about is not one of my long-term favorites. It's one that I just picked up. I was traveling, and it was one of those places where there was a little collection of books that other people had left behind, and so I picked up one of those books. I had never read anything by Margaret Drabble before. This is one of her books. It's called The Sea Lady, and I'm reading excerpts from it. This didn't actually come in this sequence. The book is kind of a mystery, and it's written with a series of flashbacks, among other things. So these are some of that. Humphrey Clark and Ailsa Kelman have known perfect happiness. They lie flat on their backs beneath the blue sea on the warm wooden deck of a large boat that rocks gently on the infantile blue waters. They listen to the slap and cluck of the small ripples of the sea. The movement soothes and assuages like a cradle, or like the movement of the waters of the womb. They are not entirely naked, for the boat has unseen and senior occupants to whom they owe respect, but their handsome young bodies are well exposed to the rays of the afternoon sun. They are both tanned, and he is golden. They are in their sexual prime, and they know that they are beautiful. Supine on the deck they lie, talking, falling silent, now and then reaching out a hand for each other, smiling at each other, sharing their school days, pooling their speculations, effortlessly crossing the barriers that divide them. Their thoughts permeate, interpenetrate, drift and spiral with the random freedom of the certainty of love. The sun beats down upon them on their closed eyelids. The future glitters before them, and they know all they have to do is to wait for it to happen to them. They are secure in the present, and their future is also secured. They have their plans, their prospects. They believe, as lovers do, that they are complementary, that they are halves of the same whole, that everything that is in them will fit into the pattern, that one day everything in them will be known to the other, and that by this knowledge they will be redeemed and completed and saved from eternal solitude. Time is suspended. He dives into the water, and she jumps after him, and they swim together away from the boat. Treading water, they embrace. Bubbles of air are trapped in the golden hair of his chest and thighs, but she is smooth and slippery like a fish. Their solid bodies meet weightlessly, supported by the thick salt water. They defy gravity. There is no effort in it. They are free. They kiss. This is the perfect happiness. It is forever. It is archetypal. It is sempiternal. Time has ceased. Eternity did not last long. Time reasserted itself unpleasantly and uncomfortably. Stage by stage, on the long, hot, dusty journey back towards the town, towards the ferry, towards Athens Airport and the airplane, towards England, towards inevitable and foreseen divergence. As they journeyed, doubts about the future surfaced, one after another. Apart, together, they had doubts, doubts that gathered strength, doubts compounded by the minor and mundane irritations and uncertainties of travel, by unconfirmed tickets and ill-considered connections, by the absence of Tampax and of soap and of paper tissues. He looked to the future guiltily and wondered whether he had been right to accept the imminent posting to distant California. She looked to the future anxiously and wondered whether she had been right to accept the lucrative, though unsecured, offer from the BBC. There they were, high on well-consummated sexual passion, bouncing along side by side in a dusty Jeep driven by a crazy Chiat, protesting their undying love and enduring union, and yet they were about to part. Of course, they knew they would never stay faithful to each other. It wasn't in the cards. They thought they had been looking forward to some privacy and a proper bed, but as they checked into the bald-faced, shabby Hotel Actaeon in the late morning, their spirits sank yet further. The bedroom was small and dark, and though the bed was wide, it was hard and low, with concealed and vicious metal corners. Within 5 minutes, as she unpacked her small bag, Elsa had barked her shin. She yelped and bled. He, too, shortly bled from her over-enthusiastic attempts to probe the weathered heel of his foot with a flame-blackened, sterilized needle. She was trying to extract the embedded spine of a sea urchin, but her search verged on sadism, and he told her quite sharply to stop. They sat together on the hard, low mattress and laughed at their injuries, but there was a forced note to their laughter, for the ambience of the room was lowering. The long, thin bolster pillow was scratchy. The mosquitoes were active. The wash basin had only a trickle of water and no plug. The lavatory down the corridor lacked paper and was blocked. That night they made love as though it were a parting, although they spoke no words of parting. Their lovemaking was not satisfactory. The gods had left them. And in the wake of the gods' departure, the mosquitoes came in for the kill.
Well, thank you to our readers for such a diverse, interesting group of readings. And I'm reminded how much I enjoy going to a bookstore, maybe in Berkeley or San Francisco, and just browsing and maybe coming up with something that I never expected, and it turns out to be a wonderful treasure. So now is our time to go home with something that may become a wonderful treasure to you, our book communion. So invite us, as we usually do, to come up row by row from the outside and then go back down and try not to browse for too long. Just pick something at random and enjoy.